extreme rescue work. Alaska's the place for it. Yet we rarely talk about the amazing feats that are performed routinely by our first responders here. But we're talking about it today. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. In 2008, the fishing vessel Alaska Ranger sank. 47 people ended up in the water. There's a book about it. Our number, statewide and toll-free, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, email talk@aprn.org, to talk to Kaylee Thompson, author of Deadliest Sea, on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
The Deadliest Sea is basically an account in the mode of the new journalism of the day of something that really happened that is so amazing that you couldn't make it up. And it is in the nature, I guess, of what they're calling creative nonfiction, to where you investigate something so thoroughly that you feel confident in putting down what went through people's heads and what they saw and so forth. And it takes a lot of research. Kaylee Thompson, you did all that research. I guess what you got started because you were interested in this for doing an article for Popular Mechanics, or how did that work?
Yeah, that's right, Steve. I actually had, it was sort of a coincidence. I'm a contributing editor at Popular Mechanics magazine, and I had an assignment for them in March of 2008 to write a story about professional rescuers, including a helicopter rescue team yet to be identified. And during the time I was researching that story, the Alaska Ranger sank in the Bering Sea, and I was able to get some of those Coast Guard rescuers on the phone. They were out on St. Paul Island, which, as many of your listeners know, is just a tiny little speck of rock several hundred miles north of the Aleutian Island chain. And as soon as I started talking to those guys, I just thought, you know, there's a big story to be told here. There's a lot more to this than just, you know, than just a short magazine piece.
Yeah, and indeed there is. So you started from the helicopter point of view rather than the typical Alaskan thing, which would be the fishing vessel point of view. So then you did go to the Marine Board of Investigation hearings and completely familiarize yourself with the whole fishing industry and the way things work there with fish masters and all.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I really had started out by interviewing a lot of the Coast Guard rescuers who obviously responded to this case, and there were quite a few of them. I mean, this was, you know, really one of the biggest cold water rescues in Coast Guard history. You ended up having, you know, two different helicopters, the Coast Guard Cutter Monroe, you know, as well as a fellow sister fishing ship involved in the rescue. So I'd started out really focusing on the Coast Guard rescuers, and then within a couple weeks of the sinking, the Coast Guard Marine Board had convened in Seattle, and I was able to get in touch with some of the survivors from the Alaska Ranger there. That was the first opportunity I had to interview some of the men who were actually on board.
I find as a journalist that these marine casualties are always very striking when they happen, and then as the years go by, they kind of sort of all blur together in my mind, and I can't separate one like the Arctic Rose from the Katmai from this one, and then it was interesting to me to read your book because it definitely threw this one completely into high relief, and yet there are a lot of things in common about a lot. I mean, sort of sadly and unfortunately, wouldn't you say, from a journalistic point of view, to see the same sort of things often causing these marine casualties. So, like, for instance, this is very similar to the Arctic Rose. With the Arctic Rose, you had, I think it was a hatch that was open and the water got in. And this thing, it looks like it might have been kind of a similar thing because when they refitted this basically oil supply boat, there were a couple of fatal problems. One was that it was a lot lower in the water as a fishing boat, and that meant that there was a hole up around the where the rudder joins in, that water would come in. And the other one, that it had these special jets that they use for maneuvering around oil rigs that suddenly go into reverse. And you don't need that when you're a fishing boat, but that it was still there, and it kicked in at a very, very bad time for this boat. So
you're absolutely right about that. And, you know, of course, starting out, I didn't know anything about some of these previous casualties. I was just, you know, really fascinated, but also shocked, you know, how could a boat, you know, we're talking about a 184-foot, you know, huge bottom trawler, 47-person crew, you know, how does a boat like this just sink? I mean, the weather conditions were difficult on the night, on March 23rd of 2008, a couple years ago when this incident occurred. But I think it was pretty clear right from the beginning, it wasn't the weather that sank this ship. You know, it was a result of a series of structural and mechanical malfunctions. And, you know, once I started looking into it, I realized, you know, what certainly a lot of people on the regulatory and safety side have known for a long time. There are really some very common themes here that you see coming up again and again. And up in Alaska, certainly, you have a very dangerous environment in the Bering Sea. I mean, there's no denying it. It's, you know, one of the most violent oceans in the world. Once you end up in the water up there, you know, you're in big trouble if you don't have all the right safety equipment. But again and again, you see these sinkings where the initial cause of the boat going down is so often not, you know, not related to the weather. It's related to a mechanical or structural problem with the ship.
Yeah. Well, let's get on to this rescue saga, because, as you say, this one really stands out. And it really, I think the benchmark for a lot of Alaskans is the Selendang IU, which was so dramatic, because here we had a cargo vessel, and it had actually broken two. And in attempting to rescue, one of the helicopters went down. And the people in the helicopter, the crew and so forth, had enough training that they were able to make it. But the people they were attempted to rescue didn't make it, and there was very adverse conditions for this. And this would have been something very much in the minds of the Coast Guard crews, that the two helicopters, the 60 and the 65. That went after this boat in the Bering Sea, and it's so interesting. You have the Monroe, which is a Coast Guard cutter that actually has a little helicopter on it. What is called the Dolphin, right?
Right, the Dolphin is also called the 65, like you said.
And then you had the Jayhawk, which was forward deployed by the Coast Guard because it was a fishing season to the Pribilof Islands. But nobody is all that close to this boat when it goes down. The closest thing to it is another boat in the fleet of what is Fishing Corporation of Alaska. So they're the closest, but they're quite far too. And the word comes out, and suddenly you've got like not one but two helicopters. It was really amazing that they were able to be as successful as they were, even though there were casualties. There were the captain, the chief engineer, the fish master, pretty much the whole top of the operation didn't make it through. But most everybody.
Yeah, that complexity of the rescue was really, I mean, that was what fascinated me about the story from the beginning when I was doing the reporting for Popular Mechanics, because you had an incident, you know, all of this transpired within really just a few hours, most of the, you know, the main action of the story, but you have so many different groups of people all coming together in this one spot in the middle of the Bering Sea. Like you said, you know, the other Fishing Company of Alaska trawler, the Alaska Warrior, you know, that crew, just the emotional poignancy of the guys on that boat. I mean, many of them were close friends, even relatives of people who were on the sinking ship. So, of course, they're, you know, going at all their might, trying to reach you know, the other fishing boat owned by their same company, and then all these Coast Guard rescuers, the decision-making that really goes into what they're doing was really fascinating to me because, of course, they're just constantly weighing, you know, the risks versus the gains. I mean, you have, in this case, just a very classic, you know, high-risk, high-gain mission, the opportunity to save, you know, 47 lives, but at the same time, they're putting their own lives at risk, and I think that all those rescuers are very well aware of that, and they're really, you know, constantly doing a cost-benefit analysis, thinking, you know, what is the best way to handle this rescue, and you know, all that decision making is something that I really talk about a lot in the book, and something that fascinated me as I was interviewing these guys. And just like you said, with, you know, this very tragic incident that happened in Alaska not too many years ago, the Sellandang IU crash, you know, these guys are all very well aware of those, you know, previous incidents where things have gone wrong, and, you know, have sort of studied what could have gone differently. So all of that background knowledge is coming into the decision making at play in an incident like this.
Yeah, I chose the term extreme rescue, and I think it's quite appropriate here. The degree of training, especially say for like a swimmer, but really for everybody, is just kind of hard to conceive of. An intensity of approach to life that is rarely seen. A degree of dedication and staying in shape. and knowing what to do in all these different situations. One thing that you point out very well in the book, and it's underscored by the Sellandang IU, is that you really need to, like, know how to deal with someone in a survival suit that's got a leak in it. You need to know how to keep yourself as warm as you can. You need to know so many things, and it makes any one of these things can make a survival difference. And so we see that in the case of, you know, in the Sellandang AU, where the whole crew of the helicopter goes down, and somehow they know enough about how to get out of the helicopter and so forth to save themselves.
Right, and I mean, it's not, you know, it's not just a matter of sitting around and talking about it. I mean, all of these guys have been through, you know, a very intensive training regimen. The Navy actually has at different facilities around the country what they call the Hilo Dunker, and this is actually a pod that's designed to be similar to the cabin of a helicopter. And, you know, the guys have to do refresher training there every few years, where they actually get into this pod, you know, in their full flight gear, and it's attached to a crane suspended above a pool on kind of a runner system where it's dropped into the pool and then it spins upside down, which is the most likely scenario of a crash of a helicopter into water, because obviously the aircraft, you know, with the rotors and everything on the top tends to be top heavy. Most likely it's going to flip upside down. So all of these guys have really been through, you know, a very intensive kind of scientific training program to teach them what to do in this type of situation. And I mean, not that that's always going to work. Obviously, it's not too easy of a task to get out of a crashed helicopter underwater. But certainly, the task is you know, nearly impossible for someone who doesn't have any of that sort of training.
And the swimmers, what a swimmer has to pass is this test where there's another swimmer in the water that actually tries to keep himself from being rescued.
Right, right.
They have a physical combat underwater.
Yep. And if if you live in Kodiak or Sitka, you've maybe seen, you know, you can sometimes pull over the side of the road and you might be seeing, you know, these Coast Guard rescue teams out there, you know, hovering over the ocean doing that exact thing, practicing these skills. You know, it's something that they do all the time, and, you know, they're really prepared for, you know, for the worst case scenario. And in the Alaska Ranger case, you know, those skills definitely came into play, because the other thing that you're dealing with is oftentimes, you know, by the time the rescue swimmer reaches the victim in the water, you know, you might have someone who is really in the later stages of hypothermia, you know, which sometimes, you know, in those stages of hypothermia, the person can really behave as if, you know, as if they're a drunk person. You know, they don't have, they may have lost, you know, kind of control of their limbs. They might be having a hard time, you know, focusing, paying attention to what the person is saying. They can sometimes be, you know, almost very combative, you know, non-cooperative. And so all of those factors sort of play into, you know, what can make that extremely difficult.
So in the case of the Alaska Ranger, there is one of the saddest things, I think, is a man that is pulled out of the water in his survival suit. He's put in the basket, and he just won't stay there. And he ends up dropping into the water, and everybody feels really bad about it. Probably will always feel really bad about it.
Right, yeah.
And what was this? This was probably one of those hypothermia things, but, I mean, they struggled with this guy.
Yeah, and this was, you know, this was one of the, to me also, this was one of the, you know, most tragic stories in the book. And this crewman, I mean, one of the things that makes it, you know, particularly tragic is that this individual crewman was brand new to the boat to Alaska. He'd only been up there he'd been on the boat, I think, 4 or 5 days. Had never worked on a fishing boat before, had never worked in Alaska before, very little experience on the ocean. He didn't even know how to swim. So when all of this happened, you know, not surprisingly, he was extremely panicked right from the beginning. I mean, even before he got off the boat, you know, obviously this is based on my interviews with other survivors, and two of his cousins were also working on the same ship. So, you know, they were able to tell me quite a bit about him and his life. And, you know, just from the moment that things went bad, he was in a very panicked position, which I think is, you know, not surprising given that he really had virtually zero safety training, with the exception of, you know, being told, here's your survival suit, you know, put it on if anything goes bad. You know, he didn't know how to get off the boat. He didn't know how to float in his survival suit in the water. He didn't know what to do to increase his chances of survival. And luckily, he ended up in the water with an older, more experienced crew member who did do his best to try to keep him calm. But by the time the helicopter arrived, you know, he was just in an extreme state of panic, unwilling or more likely unable to cooperate with the Coast Guard rescue swimmer. And, you know, the guy struggled with him for 20 minutes, finally got him in the basket. Looked like he was in there okay, but once the basket, you know, was up close to the helicopter, he ended up lifting himself up to the rail. And when the basket actually reached the floor of the helicopter, he was, you know, unable to follow the instructions of the flight mechanic, and the flight mechanic just didn't have the strength to, you know, to haul him into the basket, and he ended up into the helicopter, and he ended up falling back into the ocean. So really, really just extremely heart-wrenching, you know, story for all those rescuers, as well as obviously for this man's family.
We're talking to Kaylee Thompson. She's author of Deadliest Sea. It is a portrayal, step-by-step, moment-by-moment, wave-by-wave of the rescue, trying to rescue 47 people from the Alaska Ranger after it sank. One of its lifeboats failed. The vessel strangely kicked into reverse so that people had to swim to get to lifeboats. It was described as a galaxy of lights. It's all taking place in the darkness, of course, because it's in March. It's described as a galaxy of lights by the helicopter crew, crews of the two helicopters that would look at these strobes blinking in the water from all these people in their survival suits, 47 of them. And they rescued just about everybody. Not everybody made it. And one, I guess, the fish master, they never really found, right?
That's right. Yeah, the only person who was not recovered was the Japanese fish master, and this is a job, you know, a lot of people might not be familiar with this job. I certainly wasn't, but this particular fleet of ships owned by a company called the Fishing Company of Alaska, they actually sell all their product to the Asian market, and each of their ships has a Japanese crew member on board who's referred to as the fish master. And officially their job is to direct the boats to the best fishing grounds, you know, sort of supervise the catch in that way. Though there's a history of quite a few power struggles between these fish masters and some of the senior officers on the boat. But this particular fish master was the only one of the 47-person crew whose body was not recovered. And many of the crew members believe that he sort of chose to go down with the ship. I'm not 100% convinced of that myself, but that's sort of the, you know, I'd say that was sort of the lore among a lot of the crew on the Alaska Ranger.
Well, I mean, as the ship is filling up with water, and it didn't take very long, you had till the very last minute. You had him, and you had the captain. I think you had the chief engineer. You had the first mate, and they were like they were the last ones to leave.
That's right. Yeah, the senior officers on the ship were the ones who were with the boat until the very last minute, and you know, they stayed there, continuing to communicate with the Coast Guard as long as they could, passing on the information that they hoped would help the rescuers get there as soon as possible, and oversaw everyone else getting off the boat. So yeah, and tragically, in the end, of the people who died, it was mostly the senior officers who didn't make it.
And why do you think that was? Is it just the stringent conditions that would seem they would have been in the water less than the others?
Yeah, you're right about that. I think it's a combination of factors. Honestly, I think age and general health play a role in it overall. I mean, not coincidentally, these also tended to be the older men on board the ship. Most of the crew members were in their 20s and 30s. And these men, the captain was, 65 years old, a very slight man who ended up in a survival suit that was, not necessarily a jumbo suit, but certainly probably bigger than would have been ideal. The chief engineer had some pre-existing health problems, and some people heard him yelling, saying my heart, as he was floating in the water. So, there were some factors there that were not, it wasn't really about how long they were on the boat. I think it was more sort of their individual predicaments. Though, of course, none of those men ended up in a life raft, and that was the single most predictive factor of whether people survived, because of the 47 people in the crew, altogether 22 people ended up getting into two separate life rafts. You had one life raft with 10 people and the other with 12 people. All of those people survived. Everyone who made it to a life raft survived the sinking, and those who didn't survive were all people who were unable to get into a life raft.
Well, our telephone number here is 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email is talk@APRN.org. We're talking to Kaylee Thompson, author of Deadliest Sea, and she wrote it up for Poply Mechanics, and she made a book out of this rescue, and she was kind of specializing in reporting on the rescue, and it's an extraordinary rescue to 47 people in the water, and two helicopters involved, one of them launching from a Coast Guard boat, and having to refuel from that boat, and bring people up one by one in the basket or the hoist into the helicopters, flying to the limits of range, limits of fuel capacity, and having to basically use just about every trick in the book to pull this one off. It's a pretty remarkable tale, and definitely worth telling. I guess I would invite the callers to maybe reflect on this business of rescue in Alaska, because we have a lot of it. We recently lost a helicopter crew from Air Station Sitka. We just also lost the crew of a military cargo plane in a training flight. So there's a lot of loss in Alaska, and maybe there's some people listening who have been rescued who would like to thank those who did it. I know it's difficult and it's emotional, but we don't probably get a chance on the air and together to appreciate this as much as we might. And it's sort of, I don't want to use the word heroic, it's just tiresome, but maybe awesome is a good word to describe the dedication and concentration of these people, Kaylee Thompson, wouldn't you think?
I think that it is heroic, but it's a lot more than, you know, it's a lot more than that. It's all of those things that you mentioned, and I mean, it just makes me think. I think when I first got some of those members of the 60 Jayhawk rescue helicopter crew on the phone, I remember asking one of the guys, you know, in sort of my very naive first day of reporting, thinking, you know, you must be fearless to, you know, I assumed that they must have a certain level of fearlessness to do this job. And he quickly corrected me and he said, you know, I don't think I would want to be up there with another guy who wasn't, you know, scared out of his mind at certain moments. You know, it's not sort of a blind fearlessness. It's an intense, an intense level of training and dedication and focus, you know, that these guys are bringing to their jobs.
And functioning as a crew too, because I think there's, and you described this fairly well, there's not really a moment goes by where everybody doesn't know what their job is, and sometimes they have to hand off, you know, and the co-pilot has things they have to do. If you're on the cutter, you have things you have to do. There's this constant calculations that have to be made about fuel and weight and weather and so forth. It just seemed like everybody knows their job.
I think that's right. And the communication skills that are required to pull off a rescue like this were really, I mean, also very impressive to me. And, you know, you might think, like, I think I had the stereotype, oh, you know, these guys must be sort of, you know, macho, take charge kind of guys. And, I mean, of course, you know, it takes a great level of self-confidence. I think anyone who decides I'm going to be a Coast Guard rescue swimmer, you know, is generally going to be someone who has great confidence in their own skills. But at the same time, you know, all of this work that they're doing really all comes down to teamwork, and they need to be able to communicate very clearly with each other, you know, just constant communication. There's no room for sort of, you know, an extreme macho personality in this scenario. These guys are, you know, they're really like working together and all focusing on the communication skills.
All right. We're talking to Kaylee Thompson, author of Deadliest Sea, and we'll be back and talk about baked potatoes and hypothermia when Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
It's March of 2008. The Alaska Ranger sinks, 47 people aboard. It's the frigid Bering Sea, and pretty far out in the Bering Sea. It sinks, 47 people end up in the water. The Coast Guard manages, with the help of two helicopters and a cutter and another vessel in the same fleet as the Alaska Ranger, managed to pull 46 of 47 out of the water. And most of them make it. I'm talking to Kaylee Thompson. She writes the story up in the book Deadliest Sea. How's sales going with that book, Kaylee?
I think pretty well. I don't really get any specific feedback, believe it or not.
Yeah.
I can track the Amazon numbers, I guess.
Yeah. Have you been called upon to do talk shows and stuff about it?
Yeah, I've done a number of radio programs, and you know, there's been some newspaper reviews and things like that. So, but I guess most satisfying to me, I feel like I've gotten a positive response from, you know, a lot of Alaskans, both people in the Coast Guard and people in the fishing industry. So that's been satisfying.
Yeah, it is. In a lot of ways, the Coast Guard can easily be thought of as, compared to other military services. Maybe they're not a combat outfit, also because a lot of their work has to do with enforcement. Sometimes we might not think about that rescue part until we need it. And then we're damn well going to think about it. and that's what you do in this book. I'm sure it's difficult for the Coast Guard to get the resources to do the work that they feel very strongly is their mission and is their mission. I wanted to turn to this subject of how the survivors were dealt with once they were pulled out of the water. First off, the Jayhawk helicopter went very close to its capacity just in terms of carrying the most people it could. And I guess the Dolphin helicopter even left its swimmer in the water and came back for him later, right?
That's right, yeah. And that's another very dramatic, very dramatic story of this rescue that I tell in the book, was that, the HH-65 Dolphin helicopter, which is the one that is deployed on board the Coast Guard cutter Monroe. This is a 378-foot Coast Guard ship that, routinely is patrolling the Bering Sea in the wintertime. The helicopter is, taking off from the ship's deck. And this is, really quite a small helicopter. And it also flies with a four-man crew, two pilots, a flight mechanic, and a rescue swimmer. But beyond that, getting three or four, guys in the back of the cabin is just packed tight right in, especially when you're talking about, some fishermen who might tend to be bigger guys wearing survival suits, which obviously adds a lot to the bulk. And in this case, they got out there on scene, and there were more people to rescue than they could possibly fit inside the aircraft, and the pilot asked the rescue swimmer if he would be willing to stay behind at the scene, and he immediately said yes, that he was willing to stay behind, and they lowered him down, and he stayed in the helicopter's own life raft. So the helicopter also sort of, they decided to leave their own crew's life raft there on scene for the rescue swimmer and three fishermen that he got inside. So now they're flying without their life raft, without their rescue swimmer, rushing to deliver those first group of men back to the cutter Monroe, and as fast as they can get back to the scene, to rescue more people who now at this point include their own rescue swimmer.
And by this time, the Alaska Warrior has arrived on the scene, is beginning to figure out how to winch people up aboard as well. And I think this tale of preparation that you really wanted to tell is underscored when we see how the people are, the difference in the way that the survivors, what greets them when they get on board. Basically, on the Warrior, they have the best intentions in the world, but they don't really know how to deal with hypothermia and so forth. And on the Monroe, we see an entirely different picture. We see a totally prepared crew. We see they're taking all the blankets, putting them in dryers, and getting them warm. And they're going even to the extent of baking potatoes to put in with these guys. Maybe you could describe the type of preparations they did to bring these people back from hypothermia.
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, that contrast was really evident to me, though. I mean, of course, it's not the, I mean, I didn't see it as being, you know, the fault of these fishermen who are working on the Alaska Warrior. I mean, of course, you know, they're not trained for this type of situation the way that people on the Coast Guard cutter are. And on the Coast Guard cutter, you know, you have a corpsman who, you know, essentially a military doctor who's heading up all the preparations, and it really was like, you know, a well-oiled machine. I mean, they got this whole plan down, and then it was like an assembly line when these guys were coming down, you know, being lowered down one at a time from the helicopters onto the Coast Guard ship, and they were just, you know, they had this regimented, really, system in place on how to deal with each of these guys, you know, helping the ones who couldn't walk on their own, getting them out of their suits, getting them warmed up. You know, the ones who were the worst off, they had, you know, a special rewarming sack that they could wrap them up inside. And, you know, the care that they received, I think, was really, you know, extraordinary under the circumstances. And, you know, I think, again, it all comes down to training. It wasn't like they just waited for the moment when the first guy got there and then figured out what to do. They, you know, had spent, from the moment that they heard about the Mayday call, they had spent every second, you know, from that time until the first person arrived on the ship, preparing for how they would, you know, maximize the chances that every one of those guys was going to survive. Whereas over on the Alaska Warrior, I mean, they didn't have the training and they didn't have the same level of, you know, medical supplies that they had on the Coast Guard ship. And, you know, there was a lack of people who had been trained in CPR. I mean, there were a couple people who maybe had CPR training in the distant past, but, you know, not so many that really were up to date with the current CPR standards. And actually, the potato idea came from there were two female fisheries observers who were on board the Alaska Warrior, and they had the idea with the hot potatoes to take just, you know, baked potatoes, which retain heat really well, and warm them up in the microwave and wrap them in dishcloths and tuck them around the fishermen. So they had some, you know, some training that came back to them, you know, at that moment and kind of took on the role of sort of the nurses in that scenario.
Yeah, it gets a whole new meaning to hot potato there.
Yeah.
We're talking with Kaylee Thompson, author of Deadliest Sea, The Untold Story Behind the Greatest Rescue in Coast Guard History. And yeah, there may be a greater one come along, but this one's pretty great. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk at APRN.org. We've been doing all political shows lately, so it's kind of fun to talk about something other than that, and especially this rarely touched upon subject. I mean, somehow we get these extreme rescues in Alaska, and then we're always kind of glad to put them behind us really quickly. But they come with a distressing frequency, and a lot of them in the summertime right now. And as we speak, there could be one going on. I guess if I were addressing this show to the young people who come to Alaska to make money in the fishing business, I would urge them to be very serious about your safety drills. If nothing else, that is probably the biggest takeaway from this book. It's a fabulous account. It's a great reconstruction. It tells us a good deal about the fishing industry and its regulation or lack of regulation. But when it comes right down to it, there's no substitute for being prepared. And it really does make a difference. I mean, it makes a difference whether you have a safety drill and actually put your survival suit on or you don't. It just really seems a very, very important that this is taken very seriously.
Yeah, and one of the things, again, early on in my reporting, I was struck by the fact that, you know, there also were two federal fisheries observers working on board the Alaska Ranger, including this woman, Gwen Raines, who was the only woman of the 47 people on board the ship. And, you know, I'd been able to interview each of these people, you know, fairly early on. And it really struck me, it seemed like they had much more safety training than many of the fishermen that I had interviewed. You know, and I later realized that, in fact, that's the case. You know, every single fisheries observer that gets on a boat up in Alaska, you know, is getting a lot of information as well as, you know, at least a day or two of sort of hands-on safety training where they're getting into a survival suit, they're getting into a pool or into Puget Sound, depending on where they do their training, and they're practicing, you know, getting on their suit, they're practicing getting from the water into a life raft, you know, when they're actually in the water, and they practice pulling in other people in the water into the life raft and linking together, you know, with other people in the water, all of which are things that are very important to, you know, increasing your chances of survival if you ever do end up in this type of incident. And, you know, as far as the fishermen, it's really hit or miss. You know, some guys had really great training, and there are a lot of great programs out there, you know, both in Alaska and in Seattle, where you can go through, you know, a multi-day safety training program. But it's really up to the discretion of the companies, you know, whether these guys are getting that training. And oftentimes it's, you know, it tends to be the more senior people on board who do get that training. And, you know, that maybe makes sense from sort of a staff retention standpoint. I mean, why, you know, spend the time and money on some guy who's, you know, who might be off to a different job a month from now. But at the same time, often, you know, it is those brand new people who have no experience, no knowledge of, you know, being on a boat, of what to do in an emergency, who really need this training the most. And often they're the ones who aren't getting it.
Yeah, and you know, it really, you have to say that the only real answer for this is regulation. I mean, the best intentions in the world coming up against losing money or losing fishing time, fishing time is really likely to win from the owner's standpoint and from the officer's standpoint even. But, you know, the Coast Guard really often does not have the authority to enforce safety, things like safety drills and so forth. I mean, they can do inspections, and every once in a while they have the authority to, like, detain a vessel or so forth, but an amazing amount of it is voluntary. And in the case of the Head and Gut Fleet, it's all voluntary, really. I mean, that's kind of shocking, isn't it?
Yeah, well, they do, you know, they do have this new program in place, and it's called ACSA, the Alternative Compliance and Safety Agreement. The details of it are a little bit complicated, so I won't go into great depth, but, you know, there is definitely, you know, an acknowledgement of what the safety problems are, what can be done to, you know, to improve them, and I think a lot of these boats, you know, based on my interviews with some of the Coast Guard inspectors and people who have been working on these safety issues for a long time, I mean, I think there definitely have been a lot of improvements made. I think overall things are a lot better than they, you know, were, say, 10, 15, 20 years ago. But, you know, it is, a lot of it is still largely voluntary, and the Coast Guard inspector might be coming down, you know, to the dock periodically and watching the crew perform a safety drill, but, you know, once the boat is out at sea, they're supposed to be continuing to have a drill once every 30 days. Well, it's pretty hard to, you know, to guarantee that drill is, you know, actually involving the men putting on their survival suits, mustering, you know, at the proper places, you know, actually going through the actions of, you know, fighting a mock fire versus just kind of standing around in the wheelhouse for 5 minutes and, you know, someone pointing to the box with the survival suits and saying, you know, there they are. If something happens, put them on. So, you know, there's obviously a pretty broad spectrum, I think, of how seriously different companies, you know, take these safety drills, and, you know, the same range of how much the crew are getting out of them.
1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, and Bob joins the program from Southeast. Bob, welcome to Talk of Alaska with Kaylee Thompson.
You guys are talking about the Coast Guard. I just want to say thanks. I'm here because of them. They saved my bacon in early summer of 69, me and a partner down in the Gulf of Alaska. It was kind of scary, and I was really glad they were there.
Yeah. How did they come in? Was it the cutter as an aircraft? Or?
No, it was a buoy tender out of Juneau, the Sweetbriar. Out in the Gulf of Alaska, off the coast of Chichikov, and my fuel system plugged up with algae. Out of the fuel system, ended up dead in water for 11 hours out in the Gulf, and a storm kicked up, and they show up at 1 o'clock in the morning, and they go up on the swell, and I look at their screw, and I go up on the swell, and I look down their stack, and we're throwing monkey pod back and forth, and I'm really glad we got connected so they could tow me into Juneau.
All right, Bob, thanks for the call.
Yeah, well, thanks, Coast Guard.
All right, yeah, well, that's the whole point, and really glad to get a call thanking those guys for what they do. 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. Let's go to Gene Jones, the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Gene.
Yeah, thanks a lot for taking my call. I was a member of the Coast Guard back in the late 60s and early 70s, and it's probably the most misunderstood military service because of the five branches of military, it's the only one not in the Defense Department, which automatically creates some funding issues.
Yeah.
Now, as far as being a military service, one of the mandates of the Coast Guard is military readiness, because in time of war, they have to function as part of the military. In fact, in a declared war, the Coast Guard automatically becomes part of the Navy.
Yeah.
So, of course, we haven't had a declared war in a long time, but like as an example, in World War II, the ranks of the Coast Guard swelled to about 250,000. And then there was lots of activity in Korea and Vietnam, too. So the Coast Guard's actually been active in every war. Not, you know, the Coast Guard's kind of, the word Coast Guard is kind of a misleading name because they do much more than that.
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking about this, too, Gene, in the context of the modern situation with the Arctic, with, the ice pulling back in the Arctic more, and the Coast Guard trying to figure out how to have a presence there. We're likely to see a resurgence of the importance of the Coast Guard, I would think, budgetarily as well as just in terms of the public profile.
Well, yeah, and that's a real issue right now because at the present time, I think at the moment, I've been kind of watching the news, but I believe at the moment the only icebreaker that actually was running
right.
is not running at the moment. So the Coast Guard cutter Healy, which is an icebreaker, but it's actually assigned to scientific duty, so it's not really it's not really quite at Coast Guard disposal. So actually right now we have no icebreaker, which is going to be, you know, a pretty large thing, as you say, as the climate changes.
Well, you got that right, yeah. Thank you very much, Gene, and thanks for your call.
Thanks.
Yeah, we're talking about the Coast Guard Rescue, the Alaska Ranger, the fishing business with Kaylee Thompson, author of Deadliest Sea, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
We're talking about rescues at sea. Kaylee Thompson is with us, the author of Deadliest Sea, about the Alaska Ranger, episode in 2008. Do we know exactly how bad the conditions were when they were pulling those people out of the water with those two helicopters, Kaylee? Do we know what the seas were and the winds were?
Well, when the first helicopter that got on scene was the 60 Jayhawk that had taken off from St. Paul, where they were pre-deployed. And when they took off out there, the temperature was negative 11 degrees with wind chill. It was so cold that they couldn't actually turn on the heat in the cabin. They had, because they needed all that heat to keep the engines and the blades on anti-ice as they reached the scene. But the pilots estimated, when they first got there, the waves were about 20 feet and breaking. It was gale force winds, and I believe the temperature was maybe about between 10 and 15 degrees Fahrenheit.
And so we do know that, for instance, on the deck of the boat itself, it was covered with ice.
That's right. And that made it, even more difficult, especially after the power went out on the ship and the men are out there, in the survival suits, which have, almost booty-like feet. So, you don't have an awful lot of traction trying to move around the deck in those suits. And the entire ship was, coated with a thin layer of ice. It wasn't so much ice that was not determined to be, too much of a factor in sort of the stability problems that the boat faced. But, certainly it made it more difficult for the men to launch the life rafts, for them to move around the deck of the ship, and ultimately to get off the boat.
Let's go to Rand, joins the program from Wasilla. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Kaylee Thompson, Rand.
Steve, thank you. Let the airplane go overhead. I'm at a hangar here, and I can't talk for another 5 seconds. I've got a cabin out near McGrath. I had a forest fire out there once when a friend threw a cigarette down, and I got a letter from the DNR that was a bill for the expenses associated with the later state monitoring. It seems like a lot of the events you've described here, your authors described, are preventable to some degree. And I'm wondering whether or not the feds ever consider, in terms of deterrence, sending a bill to these larger corporations to either improve training or reduce some of the events that cause these public costs. And I'll take my answer off there.
All right, Rand, thank you for all that local color from Wasilla right there in the hangar.
Sounds like Alaska.
Yeah. Well, of course, there has been talk about rescue fees for climbing Denali. And I would probably, people in the Coast Guard might like the idea of some kind of user fee that would give them some kind of budgetary stability. But I don't know if it's really in the cards. What do you think, Kaylee?
Yeah, I think that's a good. I think it's a very good question. I don't think that there's much discussion or support of that within the Coast Guard. I mean, most people that I've talked to about those sort of issues have basically argued, this is what we're here for. We're not going to be making a judgment about who did, whose fault it was, really. Though, of course, then after the fact, the Coast Guard, also has an investigative office that is doing in-depth investigations into a lot of these incidents.
Yeah, but the thing with that is they do the investigation, NTSB, sometimes it's a full board of investigation. They put out the reports, and then somehow the recommendations are ignored. I've seen this over and over again, especially in aviation, but it's even worse with boats, really.
Yeah, it is, and it is frustrating because it really, there's obviously a lot of time, expense, manpower put into these investigations, and in fact, the Alaska Ranger and the Katmai incident, which you mentioned briefly earlier, in which seven men died, it occurred just 6 months after the Alaska Ranger. Both of those warranted what's called a Marine Board of Investigation, which is the highest level, of investigation that the Coast Guard does. This is a multi-man panel. They spend, sometimes years investigating these incidents. And then a lot of times the recommendations just, nothing ever really happens with them. It's sort of a standstill. And even how widely those reports are disseminated, I think is sort of questionable.
Well, you know, senior editors at Popular Mechanics read them, but that's pretty much it.
I've read them. I've read a few of them. Going back, you know, you mentioned also earlier the Arctic Rose, which, you know, an incredibly tragic, in fact, the most tragic fishing vessel sinking in the last 50 years. All 15 men died. This was in 2001, also in the Bering Sea, also a head and gut boat. You know, the boat just flipped over and disappeared in the middle of the night, and the entire crew was lost. And, you know, a lot of the safety recommendations that came out of that Marine Board of Investigation, you know, you see very similar kind of stuff on the Katmai and the Alaska Ranger investigation almost a decade later. So, you know, it's a little discouraging.
Let's try to get a couple more in here. Here's Jerry, joins the program from Sitka. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Jerry.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks, Kaylee. I'm with the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association. We do a lot of the training around the state and outside the state for fishermen to have them become drill conductors. And
so glad you called.
Yeah, and just wanted to, two things, actually. One, just the recent comment that Kaylee made about, yes, these recommendations show up on NTSB and Coast Guard reports, and some of them have been showing up on those reports for decades, and there's a lack sometimes of corporate, or I should say agency will to carry them out. And, you know, sometimes you also get pushback from industry on them, but the agencies have been unable to bring some of those recommendations to fruition, and it's very frustrating as a trainer to see this. And one of the things that keeps coming up all the time is training, the need for more safety training. And I just kind of wanted to clarify what you said, Steve, about voluntary training. This training for there to be a drill conductor do the drills on documented fishing vessels outside waters has been a requirement since September of 1991. So we're talking about almost...
I see, but what they were doing, the Ranger, they would do the muster, but they wouldn't bother to put the suits on.
And that is the key thing. The traditional old-fashioned drill would be sitting around the galley table talking about what they would do. And the emphasis on the regulation since 91 is that it has to be hands-on, and it has to be as much as possible as if it was a real emergency that happens, which means practicing maydays and a dead mic, putting on immersion suits, everybody taking part. We saw that with the Galaxy. Not everybody took part in those drills. Yeah. That'd be realistic. And it's hard to enforce because of the way it's written. And there's a proposed rulemaking out now. It's been out there for several years, which would make this more enforceable. But
I just
want to make sure it's very clear that this is a requirement.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for clearing that up, Jerry. Kaylee Thompson, the book is The Deadliest Sea. I assume it's available wherever books are sold.
It is, and I also have a website at www.deadliestsea.com, so you can find more information there. But, yeah, it should be Borders, Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com.
Okay.
Hopefully you can find it.
Thanks a lot. The book is Deadliest Sea. Talk of Alaska, Dave Waldron at the controls, Josh Edge, Paige Corona on the phones. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender, and by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.